This is Terry Crosby.
Andy Steiger.
Steve Kim.
Welcome to the AC Podcast. On this podcast, we want to help you understand and speak the language of our culture and address questions being asked with intellectual honesty, gentleness, and respect. We are back in black. No, not really.
No, I'm not wearing black today.
No, not me either.
More back in white, because we're going through a little of a polar vortex in BC, are we not?
Yeah, more like in down, man. I'm wrapped up in goose feathers these days. It's cold, man.
It's only minus six.
Yeah. Terry was born into negative 40. That's no word of a lie.
I mean, this is just tongue in cheek. I'm just like, what? This is polar vortex.
So what
like,
town were you born in?
Hay River, Northwest Territories. And mom and dad lived up in Fort Norman, which was three quarters of the way up Northwest Territories.
Wow.
And so dad at the time said it could get, not all the time, down to minus 70.
Mercy.
Yikes.
Yeah. But
that tells me human beings should not be there, Terry.
Right?
Don't go there. That must be close to the Arctic Circle, man.
Well, I don't know how close. It's up there. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I grew up in much colder conditions than this. Minus six, dude.
Yeah. Terry's in shorts and a tank top today and flip-flops.
This is wonderful. No. So how's it going, Steve?
Well, we've had some minus 30s here and at night dropping to minus 40 and all that kind of stuff.
You've been officially baptized into Alberta weather.
Yeah. And so I feel a lot more Canadian at the moment.
How does negative 30 feel?
Actually, it doesn't feel that bad once you step outside if you're covered. The really killer part is when you touch snow with your hand. Or if you're not covered and you're getting the wind like right in your face or something like that, that hurts a bit. But like I've said before, like you realize once you're out there that you really have just a couple minutes before you start to die. So whatever you do outside, you want to make it quick.
This is something I came up with a couple years ago when I went to Edmonton. It was negative 20. Oh, and that was in Ottawa and it was negative 20 and began to realize there's something called the death clock. And as soon as you step outside, it starts to count down. And you begin to realize you don't live in negative 20. You transition through negative 20.
Yeah. That's a very good point.
If you stay there.
But you were filming outside.
You will die.
Right?
Yeah, I filmed in negative 20. Yeah. It was horrible.
You were in jeans.
I was.
If I remember. Like, yeah. What are you doing?
Well, I didn't want to look like an idiot wearing a whole bunch of clothing. But you know what the worst part was? The worst part of filming in that kind of temperature was actually my shoes. With shoes, the cold comes straight through your soul.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and it's horrible.
Yeah, yeah.
So what I did is I bought hot packs, man, and I put them in the bottom of my shoes. I was stepping on hot packs. That is a true story.
That's a good idea. Dude, this, I don't think I can do it.
This weekend we went skiing with the fam and it was negative 16 on the slopes.
Oh.
In Hemlock, Sasquatch area.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you were to go up the mountain, I'm sure we were skiing in negative 20 up there. It was bone chilling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we had to race inside, get some hot chocolate regularly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I grew up in Saskatchewan and we would go outside in negative 20, negative 25 to go skating. And we'd be playing hockey all the time. We didn't stop. We'd come back to warm up our feet a bit, but we'd be back out. You dress for it, right? Put a few extra little socks on.
What's a toe and a finger? Here and
I have them all.
Yeah. Frostbite's not going to stop us.
All right. Well, I do have a story today. I've been digging deep into the barrel.
Right.
Okay. This one is called Drinking Ancient Mummy Juice. Adventurous individuals are clamoring to drink contaminated red liquid contained inside an ancient Egyptian sarcophagus with the hopes of gaining mystical powers. So this is another story that will turn your stomach.
shit.
I just came across this morning. I was like, oh, what am I going to say? Like, you know? And yeah.
The depths that humans will go to. That's
wow.
Right there now, there's a petition out. Well, yeah, this is a very recent story within the last week or so. 34,298 people have signed this petition hoping to get this juice out of this sarcophagus so they can actually drink it.
So they have no idea what this is. They just want to consume this red elixir.
Well, there's three bodies, bones of bodies in this sarcophagus. So there's some pictures in here. You want to see them?
Yeah, give me it.
Look at
it. Might as well.
That might be a straw. I don't know.
All right. For those of you who can't see that, which is all of you.
We should put that on show notes.
Yeah, we should.
No.
Because in my mind, what we were talking about here, Terry, was less crazy. Because I thought, okay, they have found a bottle with some juice in it, and people want to drink it, thinking it's wine or something. No, what we got here is
out of granite.
Yeah, is you got dead body juice.
Yeah, from 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, with bones floating in it, and people want to slurp that elixir.
Yeah.
You know, interestingly enough, when I was in China and Tibet, they take different animals, different reptiles, and put them into alcohol.
Yeah.
And just... they leave them there for a long time and then they drink it. You know what I'm talking about, Steve?
Yeah, I've seen it before. Yeah, even in Korea with snakes and all that kind of stuff.
Well, the scientists are saying basically it's not a good idea to do that.
No
because
kidding.
It's basically sewage. It's decaying bodies, right? So there's contains tons of microorganisms that are potentially dangerous. And there's other endospores that last in your body forever and ever. So not good.
That's really something.
Yeah. So anyway, that's people will go to any lengths
to find some
mystical powers.
Stuff. Well, and not just mystical powers, by the way, there's a news article on BBC right now. Apparently in Russia, it's becoming more and more popular to freeze people, particularly either their body, which apparently costs around $36,000 to freeze them in nitrogen, or their brain. Mm. So you have a spouse that dies or something like that. You can freeze them.
Wow.
Yeah. And then you cross your fingers and hope that someday they'll be able to do something with that. Anyway.
All right. Let's move on.
Moving
forward. We have an article that we're going to interact with. It's called The Plight of Japan's Modern Hermits. So right now, they're in Japan. There's about 500,000 people that are classified modern-day hermits. They are known as hikikomori.
Hikikomori.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Steve, there you need an official ruling on that.
Yeah. So these are recluses who withdraw from all social contact and often don't leave their houses for years at a time. So it's a severe social withdrawal. It seems like these kind of cases, not only are they happening in Japan, but happening across the world as well. So the big concern is this social isolation.
Now, this isn't some obscure news article, by the way. This is something that is causing a lot of people to think deeply about what's going on, because research continues to show, as you were talking about, Terry, that this isn't isolated to just Japan. We're seeing this taking place in many countries. We're seeing it take place in the United States, Spain, Italy, France, South Korea, India, seeing this taking place more and more. And one of the big questions that's out there is not, first of all, is why is this happening? Yeah. But then a second question is this going to continue? Like, is this going to become a major issue? Now, one thing that I came across that I thought was really fascinating, and I think is one of the important reasons why these sorts of things need to be talked about, is last January, the UK appointed its first Minister of Loneliness. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys saw that. The statistics that they were seeing found that 10% of 16 to 24-year-olds reported feeling always or often lonely.
So a big common theme is also the isolating influence of modern technology, right?
Well, that becomes a big question in all this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is what is causing this? Because I remember, you guys remember last year at the Apologize Canada conference, we had Felicia Wusong. Mm. And you know, here's a lady who's done quite a bit of research into the topic of technology and loneliness.
Yeah.
And I remember she was, you know, we were having dinner and I was asking her, why? What are the correlates? What's going on here? One of the things I'm realizing more and more is I've talked to different, you know, experts in the field, and in, even in these articles continue to come up. Don't know. Really, it's a big question mark. Is it technology? It seems to be, but what level, what kind of technology?
There's not a lot of research on it right now, right?
No.
So they're kind of looking into the future.
A lot of question marks.
Questions, yeah, yeah.
Of what is exactly causing this?
So this term, hikikomori, was coined by a Japanese psychologist, Tamaki Saito. He coined it in his book in 1998. It was called Social Withdrawal, Adolescence Without End. So this kind of research into this area has been going on for a couple decades now.
Which I thought is interesting given what we talked about in our last podcast, as we talked about renegotiating faith and we're talking about what's going on with young adults. This is a significant aspect of what is taking place in young adults these days, and has only been exacerbated as of recent. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's getting so much press attention and questions about what is going on. Now, I know that, you know, these modern day hermits is an extreme example, but, you know, my interactions these last number of years working with young adults has shown me that this is an increasing issue. This is something that in young adult ministry, we encounter regularly.
Yeah, there seems to be this sort of underlying social anxiety, right? That the what came through in the article that we read was these hikikomori people are just afraid to get out into the world and actually take risks, because human-to-human interaction actually takes risks, because you are your own person and I can't control you. I can't always come to you on my own terms. Which is what makes technology seem so attractive, right? Because with technology, you are in control of your social interactions, be it on social media or watching videos, playing video games, these different things. But when it comes to actual human-to-human interaction, I can't always have my way, because you're going to have your own ideas about how things should go. And it takes a bit of that kind of social skill of negotiating and collaborating and all of those things. And I find that a lot of young adults are just terrified of it.
Steve, if I could just ask you just some personal questions on this, because one of the things that came out in the study is, particularly in Japan, they think that this might be being exacerbated because of their culture of shame. And I know that you grew up in a shame culture there in South Korea, and with your family. I know you lived in Canada quite a bit as well, but you know, in your family, you tend to bring that culture with you to some degree. Could you just speak into that? Like, first of all, what is shame culture, and what kind of effects does that have on a young adult, and did it have on you, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, in an honor shame culture, what other people think of you matters a lot. I mean, we live in an individualistic kind of a culture in the West, and so there is less of that kind of component, right? Yeah, sure. We, especially in our teenage years, we think about it. It matters to us what our friends think of us and all those kinds of things. But in an honor shame culture, like in Asia, what other people in general think of you matters. And so then that plays into your choice of career. I have a friend from the Middle East whose friend went into, his parents expected him to go into something like, you know, dentistry, or, you know, become a physician or a lawyer or something like that. But he loved hairdressing so much, he went into hairdressing. And that was really, for this friend's father, that was really shameful that he went into that sort of thing. So you can imagine when these things kind of come together, there's this immense pressure that's put on you, whether you like this choice of career that your family has put on you, whether you like it or not, you just kind of have to go with it. You know, it's not at all uncommon in Asia to hear about this conflict between the children and the parents, you know, children wanting to do, you know, have their own way, and the parents going, you're going this way and this way only, that sort of thing. I mean, in places where enlightenment thinking has taken root it's becoming more individualistic. So Korea, even over the last few decades, has changed a fair bit in that regard. But it's that cultural undertone is still there.
Do you think that this is potentially one of the reasons why in South Korea the young adult generation has really given up in many ways? You know, one, it might be difficult, for example, to get a career. But on top of that, if you can't get the right kind of career that's going to bring honor to your family, well, then, you know, it becomes so insurmountable that you just give up entirely.
Yeah, I think in Korea, at the moment anyway, it's not so much about honor and shame anymore, but there is the element of, wow, the challenges seem so insurmountable. They have a huge problem with unemployment among young adults, the people who are just entering into society. Real estate is really expensive. And I guess this might be where sort of the honor shame thing kind of plays into it. When you get married, typically what you're expected to do is to buy your own place, an apartment or something like that, to live with your wife. And so then you can imagine if you want to get married, there's a huge cost up front because you want to have a place to call your own. And so then a lot of young adults, especially with the unemployment rate that's going on there, they find it really difficult they can't even think about how to go about, you know, buying a place to get married and all that kind of stuff. And then on top of that, their kind of work culture is such that I guess there's also that honor shame thing where there is this very strict kind of hierarchical thing. I know it's a bit stupid, but whereas in Canada, for example, you know, if your work hours are from 8 to 4, you know, you can leave right at 4 o'clock and nobody's going to bother you about it. Now, in Korea, if you did that, they even have a term for it. They call it the knife. It's like you cut off your work hours right on time, right? That's actually frowned upon. You actually can't really leave until your superiors go home. And so sometimes they end up staying until very late at night because, well, your superior hasn't gone home. So there's that honor shame culture thing. So then that gets young adults like overworked. Not just young adults either, just anybody who works in the workforce, they feel overworked. So then young adults, they find it difficult to find a home. That exacerbated by the unemployment rate and everything. So then they just give up on the big five and now just everything.
So can you address one other thing as well? I mean, there's a lot of high expectations through your parents or your relatives. And they also talked about the pressure of conforming. So there's this school of monoculture, they said in the article, and having the same opinion and it's forcing kids to not want to go to school. What is that all about?
Yeah, I can see hints of that maybe in Korea. So I can't speak into it like too directly, but one thing that I notice about the East in general is that they're very kind of collectivistic. They're very socially oriented. And so you want to fit into your in-group as much as you can. And there's such a kind of a mob mentality. On the one hand, that can be a real plus, for example, when you're trying to evangelize and things like that. There's usually a chain reaction, right? So one person converts to, say, Christianity, and that person then brings other people who bring other people, that sort of thing, which I think is one of the reasons why Christianity could have spread so quickly in Korea. But the downside, of course, is that when you are out of step with your in-group, then it's really easy to be ostracized. And so then that fear of being ostracized in, especially in honor shame culture and a bit of a collectivistic kind of a culture, that becomes a huge deal. There's a lot of social pressure there. So I can see that taking place in a school setting as well.
So this hermit culture that is developing within the Japanese culture, there's a lot of psychiatric and developmental disorders coming into play here. They're talking about mood disorders, depressive disorders, personality disorders that are affecting the young kids at this time. I mean, we see that, I think that we already see that as well as in our culture as well. It's becoming rampant just because of the use of social media and that kind of things.
I think that this definitely is an important part of what's taking place that needs to be considered, is that there are different challenges that people face. And we see that even in our culture. that often require more grace and can be a little more difficult. You know, this is one of those aspects of social media where, you know, maybe if somebody's lacking some social skills, maybe they're a little awkward, maybe they're difficult to be around. Well, on social media, I just unfriend them. In culture in large, you can see that as well, as people will withdraw from other people that are challenging or frustrating or whatever that might be. But then there's this also this aspect where those people are withdrawing from people. And so then it becomes this cycle where you are lacking social skills, so you withdraw, and now you lack social skills even more. And so there's this need to, like, and you see this where there's different organizations that are trying to help these people by re-educating them into what it's like being around people. People still need to be around people. That's where technology, you know, I would say, isn't the bad guy here. It's just being used in a way to facilitate, you know, somebody's withdrawal. Mm-hmm. And so now, instead of having a face-to-face interaction, well, I can have a social internet interaction that allows me to, you know, get by, right. But at the same time leaves me very socially inept.
It's interesting that they mention how important the face-to-face time is and just being in a conversation with somebody, but they also included it in just like video chats. That's also good, their sake, right? And it's using the media as well.
Well, they said,
and it lowers depression, they say, and compared to other social stuff.
Multiple studies have shown that face-to-face contact, either with a person or a video chat, corresponds to a lower risk of depression, which is interesting when that's compared to, say, phone, email, and especially social media. Again, I think that this is why it's important to explain that technology isn't evil. Technology isn't the problem. I often see that people want to kind of label, you know, say whether it's social media or whatever it is, as, well, that's what the problem is. Well, no, it's the same thing with lots of other aspects of our lives. You can either use those things for your good or you can use those things to your detriment. And so I think what we're seeing right now is that these technologies facilitating this, what's called turning in on yourself, which is what the hikikomori means, is this turning in on yourself. And so then these technologies, you know, they facilitate that. And so it means then that we have to be much more actively engaged in what we're consuming and how we are interacting in our world. And I think about this, by the way, here's a great example that's a very practical one. At the Steiger House, we have a rule that Monday to Thursday, dinner is eaten at the dinner table. Now, on a Friday, dinner could be eaten at the dinner table, or we could watch a movie and have dinner at the same time. So there's flexibility there. But it's pretty much a hard and fast rule that Monday to Thursday, dinner is eaten at the dinner table. And on top of that, at our house, phones or technology in general is not allowed at the dinner table. Now, why do we do that? One of the reasons I'm implementing that more and more, or that's such an important part of our family, is because I'm realizing that that's important for my health and for the health of my child. Our children are going to need to understand how to have social interactions, and they need to be okay with sitting down and having dinner as a family, face-to-face, having conversations, and learning those different dynamics that you just can't, you know, those social dynamics that you just can't learn any other way.
I think about our kids as well, and we try to implement the same thing, where we're sitting around a table. And, you know, you're interacting with each other. I mean, you can talk about how your day went, but most important, I think, for the health of the child is to talk about how their day went, mm-hmm. right? Because they're in school for 6-7 hours. There's a lot of stuff going on there.
Yeah, and helping them process that.
Helping them process, yeah.
Now, interestingly, another thing that we implement is when we go on vacation as a family, technologies can only be used in certain ways, in certain circumstances. For example, if we're heading out and we're going to be spending time with family or friends, say we're camping or we're at a park or something like that, absolutely no device, right? If there is any opportunity for face-to-face interactions, playing, exploring. And this is one thing that comes up in a lot of these articles, the importance of doing that, of playing with another human being and just making something up. You see, because a lot of our technology tends to provide us these parameters of which to play.
Yeah.
And it's important and healthy for a child and for an adult to not have those parameters put on you and to be able to know and have the ability to do things on your own, you know, come up with your own adventure, if you will.
Yeah.
And on top of that, you're doing so in a social context. And so why would I want to allow something that's going to hinder that from taking place?
Mm-hmm.
This is, I think, a part of not only parenting your children's screen time, but parenting your own screen time.
Yeah. I mean, we also, once the kids started to get phones, we actually took them from them at an earlier time in the evening, and they didn't receive them again till the next morning.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a time where they actually read. Novel thing right there.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they wound down and then, you know, were able to get a good night's sleep. I mean, that was the hope, and I think it worked most of the time, but just taking away that whole media thing really does help.
Just to give some perspective on that, by the way, I think we've talked on this before, but it's helpful to just keep in mind.
Mm-hmm.
The power of video games, the power of the internet. One of the things that comes up in a lot of these articles is the addiction level of video games and the internet. I saw this firsthand with my own children. Now, my son Tristan doesn't seem to be as engaged in video games as my son William. My son William, highly engaged. Video games are so stimulating that children can only take so much of it.
Mm.
And we found this as well with our kids. Our kids can only take about 30 minutes at a time.
Yeah.
If you let your kid play, if we let our child play for longer than that, it will mess with their mood. It causes issues. So one of the things that we've done is we've tried to leverage our children's love for video games.
Yeah.
So, and it's worked very well for us.
Yeah.
And so what we do is our kids have to read for screen time. And so they're allowed 30 minutes of screen time. They have to read for 30 minutes of screen time. We only let our kids use video games on the weekend, but if they want it, they have to read for it. Mm. And it's something that our kids, they really enjoy. They love reading too.
I have to give a shout out to Tristan because last Friday night he was with you guys at the church and he was holding this huge book. Like literally, I think it was probably like 600 pages, right?
And he was talking about it.
And I think it's in a series, right? Yeah. But he said
I believe it's called the Inheritance series.
Okay.
Part of.
But it was thick. And he was very close. Yeah. He was 7/8 just about finished this book.
Yeah, he finished it over the weekend.
But he said he would read a bit, come back to it, but he's reading other books. He said he had three other books on the go as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
How many 11-year-olds do you know who can get through a 200-page book, let alone, right?
Yeah.
Oh, and that was one of many, many volumes. So it's interesting. It does work, right? So now he loves to read and he loves playing video games. And he just needs somebody to parent that.
Yeah.
Same thing with William.
So, I mean, we did before the kids went to bed, I kind of mentioned it. We did have like a half an hour of reading time. And as we implemented that and as over the years it stuck,
mm-hmm.
if we did not get to reading time, there would be crying.
Yeah.
Seriously. So our kids read a lot, and to this day, they still do read a lot. Yeah.
So that's just one of those tips for you parents as you're navigating your way through all this as well. I want to bring up one last thing, a part of all this that I think is important, that's been recently highlighted. There is a book that came out yesterday, February 5th. It's called Empty Planet. And I think that this is really important. One of the titles on the book is the Shock of Global Population Decline, which is interesting because the UN has been saying for years that there is this population explosion, that by the year 2050 we'll have 9 billion people, and by the year 2100 we'll have 11 billion people. And this book has come out, and basically, it's challenging the UN's findings, and is basically conveying a message that we've been talking on this podcast for years about. And that is that as people withdraw socially, they're withdrawing from relationships, they're withdrawing from marriage, they're withdrawing from having kids. And basically, this book is saying, listen, UN, I don't know where you're getting your numbers from, but as we're looking at what's going on, and as we see these cultural effects, such as these, you know, hermits in Japan and other things, as we're just talking with people and asking them, you know, about their social lives, we're seeing a completely different picture that concerns us of the direction of all of this, that this isn't leading to more people, that quickly in the years to come, we're going to actually see a decline in population, not an incline.
And with the decline will come all kinds of side effects, right? Because we think of decline, you know, it's just a word. And so we think, oh, the numbers are going to go down, but it's going to have huge implications socially, economically. I mean, it's going to come with its set of pain.
Which is something that Japan is already experiencing. Because the Japanese don't allow for mass immigration, in many ways, they have kind of become a test case of what the future holds. They're not able to supplement for their lack of population. And what we've seen take place out of this is a lot of social issues and a lot of economic issues. I mean, they have been in a recession for ages. And many wonder, you know, what does the future hold? And one of the things that the article brought up that I think is interesting is they said that Japan's lost generation could be a canary in the coal mine for an increasingly disconnected society. You know, what we're seeing there in Japan, and I would argue that they're right, is what we're going to be seeing on a global scale if people don't begin to realize the importance and significance of relationship.
Well, I think we'll stop it there. This has been a very interesting article, and we'll find it on our show notes if you want to read the full length edition of it, for sure. But we really appreciate you listeners listening to this podcast on a weekly basis, and we want it to keep it interesting for you. We want to keep it informed, and we want this as a resource. And so we come back to you every week, and we hope you enjoy what we're bringing to you these last few weeks. If you really enjoy this podcast, I encourage you to go to iTunes and leave us a rating and review. That just helps others find our podcast and listen to the same stuff you're listening to. So we encourage you to do that. There's a review from Kim from Edmonton. You guys were just in Edmonton a couple weeks ago. Yeah. So this is Kim from Edmonton. She says, love this podcast. It's always engaging. It presents topics in an understandable yet thoughtful way. Also, as a Canadian, I love that it has such timely topics to what is happening in our nation. Thanks for joining us, listeners. The AC Podcast is a Ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week with more things to think about.